Members, we're going to call the Health and Human Services Reform Committee to order. And members, the first order of business is to approve the minutes. So do I have somebody to move the minutes for January 27th? Representative Schumacher moves the minutes for January 27th. Anyone have any comments to that? Okay, all those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and minutes are adopted. Members, we have Representative Sanders here with House File 180. Members, the bill is a little out of the typical context of this committee, but I'm sure Representative Sanders can explain, or the testifiers, why this is before committee, and it's my understanding that the particular part of statute that we're dealing with is regulated by the Department of Health. And so, members, I am going to move House File 180 for Representative Sanders, and I understand that there is an amendment, Representative Sanders.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. There is an author's oral amendment, which I believe you have a copy of in front of you. This is in conjunction with working with the department and is basically their language. We appreciate you putting it on, please.
Okay, members, I will move the amendment be adopted to get the bill in the order that the author would like. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. And we have the bill in the shape that you want, Representative Sanders. And so with that, I will turn it over to you to explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, members, this we were a little surprised as well that we had to come before health. But as the chair said, the Department of Health does license manufactured homes, manufactured housing here. So that is why we're here. We will try and be brief. But what this bill really does is it allows... strike some language in statute that would allow for owners or occupants of manufactured homes to actually park in their driveways, even if those driveways are less than 10 feet away from the next manufactured home. So the main impetus for this, again, is safety. A lot of these streets are not as wide as typical streets. And therefore, some of these residents were having to park on the actual street. It makes it very difficult, if not impossible, for large fire trucks, paramedics, ambulances to actually maneuver down these streets if cars are parked in the streets. So what we want to do is just remove this language, allow cars to be able to be parked in the actual driveway on their own property, and clear up the streets for safety purposes. I have today Mr. Bruner from the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. I'd be happy to say another couple words.
Thank you for being here, Mr. Bruner. If you want to introduce yourself for the record and go on with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Mark Bruner. I'm with the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota, and we represent the builders of manufactured modular homes, sales centers, as well as the manufactured home park communities. There are approximately 900 of them in the state of Minnesota, and there are maybe 180,000 residents who live in those communities. We're regulated, at least from a licensing aspect, for the manufactured home parks by the Department of Health. And in 1951, the legislature adopted the first set of licensing requirements for manufactured home parks, which included a provision that essentially said that you could park your vehicle in your driveway as long as it wasn't 10 feet from the nearest adjacent home, which everyone interpreted to mean your neighbor's home. The plans for the designs of these manufactured home communities were submitted and approved by the department, and everything was fine until a couple of years ago when there was sort of a new interpretation of that statute, which essentially would preclude most residents or homeowners from parking their vehicle near their home, and in many cases would require vehicles to be parked on the streets, which, as Representative Sanders pointed out, is problematic. They tend to be narrower streets, and the fire departments wouldn't permit that. So the intent of the bill in working with the department is to essentially allow these homeowners to park their cars next to their homes like someone would in a typical subdivision.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner. We do have a couple of questions. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My concern is if you remove this language entirely, then I could park my car right next to your mobile home, and a lot of mobile homes aren't the best air filtration systems in the world. What about the fumes from my motor vehicle getting into the next motor home if it's parked right next to it a couple feet away?
Mr. Bruner.
Well, Representative Mullery, I guess the idea is, you know, if you say your car is running or something, the fumes, I mean, that it'd really be no different than if it were a site-built home and you were parked next to your site-built home having to worry about exhaust or whatever, or your vehicle were in your garage. Obviously, it wouldn't close the garage door, but in this case, there wouldn't be garages, so the fumes would dissipate.
Representative Mullery.
But when you have an attached garage, the homes are built to make sure that doesn't come, isn't a problem. I'm just wondering, is there somebody from health, that Department of Health, can assure us that this can't be a problem?
Do we have anyone here from the department who would want to speak to this issue? You could introduce yourself for the record briefly and respond to the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Dale Dorschner, Assistant Division Director for Environmental Health. We looked at this, and as the testifier stated, it's outside, so we see that the dilution of any exhausts would be mitigated.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a follow-up to that. That was actually my question as well, but do these manufactured homes have an intake at all, air intake, where you wouldn't want a motor vehicle parked nearby? Even though it dissipates into open air, is it a concern that if it's by some intake or the heating system or something, that could be a problem?
Mr. Bruner.
You know, Madam Chair, Representative, I guess that has never been a concern, and I guess I don't want to say this, but right now, or for the past 60 years, we've been operating essentially under the same guidelines that we're looking at just sort of bringing the statute into compliance with, and I'm not aware that it's been a concern, at least to this point. Thanks.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you. Do you know what the intent was when this bill was originally drafted and passed, this 10-feet rule?
Well,
Mr. Bruner.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, sort of. I took the time to try to research it this past summer because this particular issue went to an administrative law judge. And I looked at the committee minutes down at the Minnesota Historical Society from 1951. And there really wasn't any intent or discussion here relative to safety, that kind of thing. It was more of an aesthetics kind of discussion. So there really wasn't anything at all in the record or any discussion on the floor.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm kind of have a question about the effect of the oral amendment that was adopted. As I'm looking at that, the bill with the oral amendment has the effect of disallowing other property from being stored between these mobile homes. And I don't know why we would want to do that. Why are you trying to do that? Is that, obviously that's an important part of this bill, or the oral amendment would not have been adopted. So could you speak to that a little bit? So we're changing this now from allowing the space between manufactured homes to be used for parking motor vehicles and other property, and now this would forbid, it would say the space between manufactured homes may be used for the parking of operational motor vehicles, period. So to me it looks like you're changing the law to forbid other property from being placed there. Is that the intention here?
Mr. Bruner.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, It's probably best to have the department address that. It's essentially their language that that we agreed to, so they can best explain it.
Thanks for coming back. If you could just repeat your name briefly and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Dale Dorsner, with Assistant Division Director with the Environmental Health at the Health Department. The reason why we asked to strike the property was we didn't want too much clutter in there, so we were thinking about inoperable vehicles, maybe RVs, campers, those kind of things in there, but just to allow for parking of vehicles that are usable.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, that seems to me that a kind of a bigger change here, and one that really people who live in these manufactured home parks might really object to that kind of a change. I mean, the bill comes in originally saying that, you know, removing this distance restriction. And I get that, and I don't think that, you know, that might be okay with people who live in these parks. But I represent quite a few people who live in manufactured home parks, and I do not think they would like it too much if I voted to not allow them to put property where they currently can put it. So I'm having a real problem with this, Madam Chair, as it's been amended, and so I guess maybe we should have a little more discussion about this. Actually, Madam Chair, I'd like to move to delete the oral amendment. I think that the bill doesn't need that to achieve the purpose that was originally brought here to do. And I'd like to have a roll call on that, please.
Representative Sanders, do you have a response to Representative Liebling's concerns?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I guess my response is this is language that the Department of Health brought to us. If you delete the oral amendment, you're kicking out the department's language and leaving the bill the way that we originally had the bill drafted. So, you know, I guess, Madam Chair, it's up to the will of the committee, but this was us working with the Department of Health to have a bill that they felt good about.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still a little confused on this other property. So could other property be included to people who have just the regular bicycles out there? And I asked from the aspect, in my community, there's a lot of folks who, that's where they store their kids' bikes, is, you know, within that distance. Would that be considered other property? And if so, that, you know, even raises the concerns I have on it even higher.
Mr. Bruner, to that point.
Well, I'd best to defer to the department. They'll be making the interpretation on licensing and issuing citations on what would be considered, property that shouldn't be there.
So. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question about the wording of the language that's here. It says the space between manufactured homes may be used for the parking of motor vehicles. There was some discussion about driveways. People should be able to park cars in their driveways. I'm just wondering, the way it's worded, it makes it sound like the only place you can park or put your other property, if we get rid of this amendment, is between the vehicles, is between the homes, but the driveway might be in front of the home. And I'm just wondering if the way it's worded in existing law right now prevents any cars or other property from being located in a driveway that's to the front of the house.
Mr. Bruner, and then we may need some clarification from the department on that question. Mr. Bruner, do you have any comments to that?
Madam Chair, to my knowledge, that hasn't been an issue in terms of where driveways, you know, may be in front of the home. The home may be set back far enough from the street that would allow that, and if they do that, it would have had to have been submitted to the department for approval.
If I could have Mr. Dorsner from the department come forward and maybe just speak to Representative Freiberg's question, and then I have a follow-up to that.
Madam Chair, as he's coming, really quick, I think the word may in there makes it somewhat permissive, but again, it's up to the department on how they would be issuing licenses around that. But operational, I think, is an important word, especially in a lot of manufactured homing associations. I mean, you want movable operational cars that are parked in those driveways to be able to be moved if they need to, and not just storage. In fact, many of the parks have rules about your car has to be operational. So I think that term in the oral amendment is important, but I always read it as the space between the manufactured homes may be used for parking operational vehicles, and at least in Blaine, almost all of the homes, their driveways are in between the homes, and some homes do have driveways, but again, the may makes it permissive, but driveways that are in front, and that's typically on a corner, and all the rest of the homes would have, the driveways would be in between the homes.
Thank you for that, Representative Sanders. Mr. Dorschner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Should I state my name again?
Yep.
Dale Dorschner, with Assistant Division Director with Environmental Health at the State Health Department. In terms of the property, I think we were looking at non-movable property, and I'll concede that, you know, bicycles and things like that, other property that are stored, whether it's lawn furniture or something, that's not what we were thinking about, and we would be amenable to changing that out if needed. But we were looking for more property that is inoperable and is hard to move.
Thank you for that clarification. Well, my understanding, to your point, Representative Liebling, is that what the Department of Health is going after here is safety and making sure that the property is operational and movable. And so I don't know if any of that explanation helps your concerns, or if there's a minor thing that either the department would consider to address Representative Liebling's concern. Otherwise, if you want to keep your amendment on the table, Representative Liebling, we can move forward with the vote. But at this point, as this is the Department of Health, and your interest is safety and moving this thing forward with the amendment in, I would support it as it is and encourage Representative Sanders, if there is any type of a change that can be moved in the next committee to address a little bit of this technical issue, that can certainly be done. But Representative Liebling, to that point.
Madam Chair, I guess I have a question for the department, and that is that this, and I'm not familiar really with this whole section of law, and I probably very few of us are really. I wouldn't have thought about this as a health issue, but so it seems to me that what we're doing here in law is kind of setting minimal standards, but as I'm understanding it, it seems like the mobile home park can set additional standards. They can say, we're not allowing any bicycles closer to the home, or we're not going to let you park your car so you can change the muffler. We're not letting you put that. And that what the current law does is just that it says, you know, you got to keep it all 10 feet away from the home, and that's the bottom line. And then it's up to the local, you know, either the park owner or the local government to change it. So I don't know why we would, in state law, put that minimal standard so high. I mean, I still really don't get that. And I understand that that's not the department's intention, but that's kind of how I read the law. So I guess what I would do, Madam Chair, is this, I think in the initial motion, Madam Chair, I don't think you said where this is going. Is it going somewhere else?
It is going somewhere else. Thank you for that, Representative Liebling. It will be going to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability next.
Okay. Madam Chair, I mean, I don't, if it wasn't the intention to bar folks from putting their property next to their home, which is what this language does, I'll remove the roll call. I'm going to vote no on the amendment, on the bill, however, if it stays like this. because I'm really concerned about what it actually is doing, even if that wasn't the intention. And I guess I'm assuming the bill is going to move forward, and I would just ask Representative Sanders to take another look at this, because obviously it's not your intention to do that. But this is kind of, the bill came in sort of under one guise, and it's sort of leaving doing something much broader. And we haven't really had a chance to think of it that way. And I think it really bears some rethinking so that we're not impacting people's lives in a way that's not only really too restrictive, but wholly unnecessary. So with that, Madam Chair, I guess, I'd still like a vote on removing that oral amendment. People can, I suppose, vote however they want. I think it would be better to move it forward without that and then consider later on what to add rather than moving forward something that seems kind of troubling at this point.
Representative Mallory.
I can't remember your name from the health department. You keep saying that it's a health issue. I don't understand why it's a health issue to have property there. People in the city that have homes have property in their yards, and you don't come out and say, no, you can't have this. Another thing is operational. I know a lot of people, and I don't have any mobile homes in my district, but there's a lot of people aren't incredibly wealthy that live in mobile homes, and to say an operational, I know a lot of people in my district that have had a vehicle in their yard that isn't operational for a while until they can afford to get it fixed. Something might go out. It might even be really simple, like an alternator or rotor, anything. And so suddenly they can't have it there under what you're saying for some health reason. Just because they can't afford to fix maybe even a few $100 at a particular time, they have to get rid of the car for health reasons. I just don't understand where you're coming from. And rather than just saying this is a health issue, I'd like to know why it's a health issue. Why people can't store their property and it's a health issue. Why is it a health issue, not just that it is?
Mr. Dorschner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. What we were concerned about is somebody, we're usually not addressing these issues with the majority of them, but those manufactured parks that aren't well managed or the management is absent is typically when we get the complaints. And what the concerns that I heard through our inspectors were parking an RV that may be used, frankly, as an addition to the mobile home was their concern. So we wanted to make sure that to add operability there, that we don't have an RV parked right next to the mobile home and it's an additional room to it. So that's the intent of it. It's not, the intent was never to say that no stalled cars could ever be parked in a residential
Representative Mallory.
I'm sorry. If we're, you don't hit with a sledgehammer something that you can press a thumbtack and break the whole thing. If you have a particular reason why there's a health, I can support you. I can't support just saying this is a health thing and not coming up with a good reason why it is. And it clearly is not a health thing to have such an incredibly broad statement as you've got here. It just is not a health thing from what everything you've said. I don't have a problem with what you want to get at, but it should be drafted to that.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to make a suggestion, but I'm thinking at this point we really need to have them rework that whole sentence.
Representative Mason, to that point, and Representative Liebling, to your motion, it's my understanding that the author of the bill, certainly not intending to come at something with a sledgehammer and have unintended consequences, and it sounds like the Department of Health is willing to maybe rework this language a little bit so that it hits what you're trying to address maybe a little bit more narrowly. And so with that, why don't we take up Representative Liebling's motion to strike the oral amendment or the A1 amendment that we already added into the bill, and we can take a vote on that and then proceed forward with the bill. Is there any discussion to that, members? And Representative Sanders, do you have any comments on that?
No, again, striking the oral amendment, which was the department's amendment, puts the bill back the way we had it drafted originally. So happy to work with the department, and hopefully you'll work with the department as well to get them language as well that you find appropriate.
So Representative Liebling moves to strike the A1 amendment from the bill. Is there any discussion to that?
Can you read the A1 amendment?
I can read the A1 amendment. Everyone should have a copy. What it does is on page 2, line 6, after the word of, insert operational and strike and other. And on page 2, line 7, strike the word property. And so, members, we are striking the oral amendment. Are there any questions about what we're doing? Okay. All of those members in favor of striking the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no?
No.
The motion prevails. The motion, the oral amendment is struck from the bill. With that, we are back to House File 180. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and several people have commented how this is kind of an unusual topic that we haven't, as a committee, dealt with very much. And I would just say, if we're going to have future bills on this topic, maybe we could ask our House research staff to do a little background with the local government researchers as well, and explain why we have in state law provisions that normally we would delegate to cities about land use and zoning and use regulation and those sorts of things. I assume it was maybe put in historically when there were a lot more unincorporated parts of the state and someone would just throw up a mobile home park or something. But I don't even know if most cities are even aware that this exist or would want us to be involved in that. And so if we're going to start to see a lot of these, it might be useful for us to have a better context, because I'm having a hard time trying to imagine what, you know, all the things a city would want to think about in this sort of thing, let alone a resident. And I don't have any of these in my district, but I hope that those of you who do will reach out to, there used to be an All Parks Alliance for Change, I think their name was, but it was a residents organization, and I think we'd feel more comfortable if we just heard them say, oh yeah, this is common sense, no problem, because we just want to not do unanticipated things, either that limit the authority of a city or the residents who are our current tenants.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. I think it comes to everybody on the committee, and certainly Representative Sanders, as a bit of surprise that this bill is in this committee, so something for us all to maybe look at and learn more about in the future. Members, any other discussion to House File 180? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this may go to the point that the Department of Health may be trying to make, but in northern Minnesota, we had a family that was living in an RV, and they suffered from carbon monoxide poisoning. And so I'm not sure if that was the Department of Health's argument that they don't want people living in RVs. And I don't know if they're going to address it in this bill, but I just wanted to make sure that maybe is the health connection, but I'm not sure unless they tell us in the future.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sanders, reading on page 2, the space between manufactured homes may be used for parking of motor vehicles and other property. To me, that looks as if it could extend into the property and isn't restricted to just a paved or a gravel drive. Is that a too far-fetched of an interpretation?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cuomo, I guess I'm not quite sure what your interpretation was, but I would say, I mean, you still have to remain on your property. Each home is on a specified property, and you'd have to stay within the side of the property line that you are occupying or have ownership of.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It doesn't seem to distinguish property there. And when I was married, instead of apartment, we bought a trailer and lived in a mobile home park. And we thought that, you know, that was a choice while we looked for a house. And frankly, there are a lot of different configurations. And there were people that had boats, you know, bass boats in between the trailers. And there was quite a bit of variability, shall we say, even within the park of how things were. And that's why when I'm reading this and I'm listening to the discussion, that comes to mind of where that's not an uncommon practice. And I enjoy the intent of the bill and the effort. I just am curious why 2 or 3 feet, because these, you know, so you'd make sure that there was accessibility to be able to work on your trailer. And people that are used to zero lot lines in houses, that's spacious compared to zero lot lines in trailers. So that's just, you know, some questions and thought.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 180 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the bill passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's been very enjoyable.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. I think that was fun for everybody.
Thank you. It was a hard bill.
Okay, members, with that, back to things that we typically talk about in this committee. We have a presentation from MMA, and so I will call those folks to the table. Thank you so much for being here. If you want to introduce yourself with the record and move forward with your presentation, that would be great.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and representatives of the committee, I am Dr. Douglas Wood. I'm a cardiologist at the Mayo Clinic, and I'm also the medical director of the Center for Innovation at Mayo Clinic. But I'm here today in my capacity as chairman of the board of the Minnesota Medical Association to discuss with you some things about physicians in Minnesota, and also discuss what I think are some really common goals between our organization and the citizens that you represent and the desires that you have for your constituents. While we're moving to advanced technology, and I appreciate all the great technical help, a few things about the Minnesota Medical Association and its activities we'll share with you today. And I, at this juncture, will tell you that I'm happy at the discretion of the chair to be interrupted at any time with questions, or we can wait until later. The MMA is an organization that is now more than 160 years old, and as a professional organization represents 10,000 physicians and physicians in training in the state of Minnesota. We are dedicated as a professional society to advancing the health of the state of Minnesota, as well as the practice of medicine and the medical profession in achieving that goal of sustaining the health of our citizens. We have three major strategic goals for our organization. The first simply is to help Minnesotans be the healthiest in the state, or healthiest in the nation, if not the world, I might add. And making Minnesota the best place to practice medicine is our second major objective. And our last strategic goal is to advance professionalism in medicine. If we think about physicians in Minnesota, there are currently about 22,000 physicians who are licensed by the state of Minnesota, and about 17,000 of them are resident or located in the state of Minnesota. 14,000 of them are practicing medicine. In Minnesota, we are actually a state that is somewhat ahead of the rest of the country. For many years, the practice of medicine in Minnesota has been marked by large group practices, practices of 100 physicians or more. And many of them are actually not-for-profit medical practices. It's interesting that around the country, this trend is actually accelerating. And I think it's the unique model of the state of Minnesota of these kinds of practices and an orientation toward not-for-profit aspects of health insurance that, in my mind, made Minnesota a better example for how to craft health reform than for the United States than other examples. So when we think about physicians and what it takes to become a physician, this is an important concept to consider, especially when we have to think about things about manpower training and how long it takes us to prepare people to work as physicians. So after obtaining a four-year college degree, a medical school program of, on average, 4 years is followed. There are some physicians who actually take 5 years to graduate because they pursue additional training at the same time, in particular trying to obtain a master's of public health or other training that would help them in their roles of caring for different groups of patients. After training in medical school, then residency, which is your training in your elected specialty, begins. And it ranges, on average, from 3 to 7 years, although if you are pursuing training for a subspecialty, for example, pediatric neurosurgery, you might be training for longer than that additional 7 years. So it takes from 11 to 18 years to prepare a person to function as a physician from the time that they start their training. So if today we decided we wanted to increase the number of physicians in the pipeline, it would take us nearly 2 decades to see the potential benefit of that change in our planning. After residency training and licensure in the state, then board certification is another marker of physician performance. So the specialty boards require physicians who are candidates for their diplomacy to pass usually a combination of written and oral examinations, again, depending on the specialty. And it is also required now that those examinations be repeated on a regular basis. So most physicians will repeat their specialty certification examinations or some process that will sustain their knowledge every 6 to 10 years. Now, if you think about the number of specialties and subspecialties, there are now about 150 specialties or subspecialties of medicine. And to give you a little sense about how that's sort of developed, I mentioned earlier that I'm a cardiologist, and I finished my cardiology training in 1983. So in 1983, you could be board certified as a cardiologist. Now you can be board certified as a cardiologist, an interventional cardiologist, a nuclear cardiologist, an electrophysiologist. And soon you can be certified as a transplant or heart failure cardiologist. So there are now, in essence, 6 different subspecialties of the specialty of cardiology. So that reflects the complexity of the development of knowledge in medicine as well as the procedural practice that has gone with it. Physicians are committed to a lifetime of learning. Dr. Will Mayo said, once you start studying medicine, you are never done. And so as an organization, one of the things that we do a lot of is continuing medical education, but others in the state, including the University of Minnesota and Mayo Clinic's College of Professional Development, also work to provide continuing medical education for our physicians. And currently, state licensure requires about 75 credit hours every 3 years. Licensure, of course, requires in Minnesota a minimum of a degree, passing the examinations for licensure, and 1 year of residency. This is a topic that we'll come back to talk about a little bit later in terms of the legislative compact for interstate licensing. Now, a few things about the MMA priorities for legislative activity in the year. We organize these into 3 broad areas. One is access to care. The second is access to treatment. And the third is really the access to the best chance of health for the citizens of the state. So in the realm of access to care, some of the most important things for us to consider is that, especially with the ability now to increase the number of people who have access to insurance. Simply having an insurance card does not guarantee access. We know that there are projections of physician shortages nationally and in the state of Minnesota. If we continue to use our same models, then that shortage would be about 45,000 physicians by 2015 and 65,000 by 2025, at a time when the population continues to grow. And the illnesses that are suffered by all of us as we grow older require more and more care and attention. And as you might imagine, this puts tremendous pressure on our workforce capacity. The time of training, as I reflected to you earlier, is so long that it is difficult to provide rapid responses simply from the perspective of adding a number of positions in medical school. The other difficulty in terms of adding physician positions is that the residency slots are controlled by the federal government with their educational payment policy. So Medicare is the most significant funder of graduate medical education, and Medicare has limited the number of residency slots. And so relatively soon, if we continue to expand the enrollment of medical schools in the country, we will produce more graduates from U.S. medical schools than there are slots available to train in residencies in the country. So this is a problem that's obviously beyond the scope and purview of what this committee can do, but it is something that we have to be cognizant of and think about as we think about a comprehensive approach to planning for future manpower needs for professional training. Now, the other difficulty here is that physicians as a group, like all other groups, are getting older. So you can look at me and figure that I'm potentially close to retirement age. 63. I'm not thinking about retirement now, but there are lots of people like me. And actually, I look around every year and am amazed at how many of my colleagues are retiring, because most of us thought we would practice for a long time. There are some things that are developing in certification and other requirements that are making physicians tend to think about retiring sooner. And so these may be some other things that may come into consideration later. They're not in front of us in the state now or in the near future. There is a graph that you see that shows the Minnesota primary care physician gap and its growing size. And what this really represents is the recognition that if we continue to try to train physicians the same way that we always have, we will have a growing gap. And immediately then, I think it is clear that we need to think about different ways of delivering care to people so that we don't have to worry about the older model of care dependent on a single physician and a single nurse working together, for example. So in that regard, if we think about access, and I'll advance really fast here. So if we think about patient access to care, being able to make sure that we can encourage physicians to locate where people live is important. Addressing student debt, particularly loan forgiveness, is a proven strategy that will help us direct physicians to live and work in areas where they are needed. The MMA is greatly appreciative of the work that you are doing to try to help address these issues, and even the MMA Foundation is working to try to supplement these activities by encouraging all of those who are interested, especially physicians, to make regular contributions that help us to sustain these activities as well. But your partnership, of course, is invaluable.
Dr. Wood?
Yes, ma'am.
Excuse me for just a moment. We have a question from one of our members, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, I want to go back to your comments and also the slide where we talk about legislative priorities and your comments about the shortage of manpower.
Yes, sir.
And whether you're a plumber or an electrician, and you know what I'm talking about, I'm wondering if the specialization that the cardiology profession has undergone isn't a bit symptomatic of the way in which you bill for the services that you provide under a Medicare DRG program. I'm wondering if you would be willing to elaborate if that manpower shortage wouldn't be as severe if specialization hadn't occurred. And I have a follow-up.
Dr. Wood.
Madam Chair and Representative, the payment system that the United States uses as fee-for-service does create those unusual incentives. So if we think about how we value a cardiologist's work, since I'm a cardiologist, I'm going to use that. Let me give you an example that I have shared with other groups before, and it is in the treatment of someone who has coronary artery disease or blocked coronary arteries. It is not the DRG system that is the issue. It is actually what is called the Relative Value Reimbursement System, or Resource-Based Relative Value Reimbursement System, or RVRVS.
Yes.
So in this system, what is done is that a committee supervised by the American Medical Association and Department of Health and Human Services in Washington try to understand the real input prices of medical care. And then they try to determine an amount of work that is done by the physician and then create a payment based on that. So if I think about a person with coronary disease, I am not an interventional cardiologist. I will see a person with coronary disease in my office, and I may spend an hour talking to them about the things they could do with their diet and their exercise and medication to minimize their symptoms and also prevent the development of the disease. If I were an interventional cardiologist, I could ignore that and say, I'm happy to put in your stent. Now, it takes me about an hour to put in a stent, so I would get paid roughly about 10 times the amount to put in a stent that I would get paid to do the basic work to prevent the disease or manage the disease. So this is the problem with the fee-for-service payment system. Now, if we could change the payment system and say, okay, what if we paid you, Dr. Wood, to keep this person healthy, meaning be able to function with their coronary disease, I would have a different incentive about what to do. So if that structure of payment for a global episode of care meant that I would do better if I kept that person healthy and did not require surgery or angioplasty, then that would do a couple of things. First, it would actually improve the health for the patient. Second, it would likely reduce costs because we would avoid unnecessary angioplasties or surgery. And third, it would help us concentrate on actually making people healthy rather than treating with an operation. And here's what I mean by that. It is remarkable that if you look at bypass surgery, that for people who were working before they had their bypass surgery, 30 to 70% of them, depending on which study you read, do not go back to work after the operation. So we tell them to have an operation. We measure the performance of the hospital based on complications and mortality, but we don't measure the performance based on the ability to get a person back to their level of health, meaning their ability to do the things they want to do. So that really would be a very significant form of changing payment or payment reform. I would say we're only beginning to think of those things in the U.S. There's a little bit being done nationally, but we could probably advance those sorts of things a little faster in the right circumstances.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, Doctor, because I was hoping that you'd go down that rabbit trail with me, we are now under the constraints of the American Affordable Care Act, Obamacare for that sake, and we also have MNsure. With those constraints in place, I'm wondering if you'd be willing to elaborate in terms of how manpower shortages will occur, and in the ideal model that you just described, is it even achievable under the current healthcare system?
Dr. Wood.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright. A couple of things about the Affordable Care Act. It is a very complex piece of legislation. I will tell you that I was privileged to be involved with Mayo in terms of trying to influence its development. There are some pieces in the Affordable Care Act that try to address shortages of manpower. And a couple of things that are important in that. The Act actually did improve payment for physicians taking care of Medicaid patients for a short period, just 2 years. The Act did try to provide additional payment for physicians who were willing to work in shortage areas. And the act also tries to provide for some other financial changes that could help recruit physicians of different groups, for example, general surgery to rural areas. So there are some pieces of the act that try to address that, but again, going back to the discussion we had earlier in terms of the timeline, it's a little difficult to expect to see certain changes, and what are in the act don't really create a burden necessarily. The burden really is, in terms of these changes in physician payment, is they were all very temporary. And so if we were, again, to encourage physician entry into less specialized areas, for example, primary care or internal medicine, then there are ways we can do that, I think, separate from anything that's in the Affordable Care Act. I personally would not consider the Affordable Care Act as being an impediment to us in Minnesota of moving forward with what we think of would be good policies.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Manager.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Doctor, I'd like to move from looking at the trees and look at the health of the forest as a total. If we look at the, and you mentioned incentives, what the incentives of MA and other government programs giving reimbursement below cost have done, you know, over the past decades where hospitals, Mayo included in Scottsdale, had to step away from, you know, providing that service. I'm more concerned, I have concerns about the specialty and having general practitioners, etc., but I have more concern about the incentive with going even more so into a below-cost structure. Isn't that, there's some incentives for retirement and disincentives for maintaining the number of physicians we need?
Dr. Wood.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I'm not sure I understand the question entirely in terms of the low-cost structure. Are you meaning looking at lower paid providers or lower reimbursement rates to providers?
Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, lower reimbursement rates below cost. I mean, that was pretty open when different hospitals stopped taking new patients. Dentists closed facilities in certain areas because of the proportionality of MA and Medicare, of where it wasn't fiscally capable, and with the shift of doctors retiring and shifting to concierge service, that would infect the entire population, not just what specialties.
Dr. Wood.
And Madam Chair and Representative Quam, so for the members of the committee, in terms of payment below cost, it's important to recognize that many Medicare payment policies result in payments that are below the actual cost of producing care. And to the degree that Medicaid reimbursement may be less than Medicare, then that problem is exacerbated. The result can be several things. One is that there is a cost shifting that occurs so that the rest of us pay higher costs. The second is that access may be constrained. So if a delivery system or physicians feel that they no longer can afford to stay in business at those payment rates, they may decide to leave that practice or leave the area. As a result, then, not only do we create constraints in access, but we actually affect health adversely because things go untreated or undone that should have been done. So I hope that answers the question or provides the clarity that you were seeking.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's sort of tied into some of the discussions we had yesterday, and I thought it would be good to have Dr. Wood elaborate on some of those dynamics we're seeing in parts of our state.
So I appreciate the lead-in. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the lead-in. And clearly then, when we think about making an investment in especially access and primary care, those primary care payment rates are very important. We do have a graph that shows you the payment rate for Medicaid compared to Medicare in Minnesota for different services, and I think it actually illustrates the point. Now, when access is problematic because of the combination of payment issues, as has been elaborated by Representative Quam, by changes in demographics or by physicians deciding to retire and not being able to recruit new physicians to replace them in rural areas, we need to think about different models of care. I have to tell you that as the medical director for the Center for Innovation at Mayo, it's a pretty exciting time to think about how we can apply new technologies that allow us to take care of people where they are, meaning at home. The term telehealth is used in this slide, but also is used quite extensively. And I'll tell you that in our group of folks who are working on these matters, we prefer to call this connected care and not telehealth, because telehealth tends to imply that you are doing this with a relatively old technology of face-to-face television visits, and you just don't have to do that. And I'm going to give you a quick example of what we really mean by connected care and why it's important to think about the prospects of being able to advance the Interstate Licensure Compact, which is House File 321 that Madam Chair and several of you have been good enough to begin to advance. Last Thursday, I saw a gentleman who came with concerns about his fatigue and that he was found to have an enlarged non-functioning right kidney by his physicians at home. And they thought the cause of that was because of an aneurysm in an artery that crossed over the ureter. However, when he arrived and brought with him the report of his CT scan, the possibility occurred to me that there could be something else going on. Now, he came from across the Minnesota border, and so because of the limitations in how we can look at images, I can't look at his images if he's in Wisconsin. He has to be in front of me. I can tell you I could have answered the question very readily by just having the opportunity to see the images without anything else. So when we talk about connected care and about the compact, what we really mean is an ability to project the expertise of specialists and others way beyond artificial borders to help people. So I could actually have helped this gentleman. I could have made the diagnosis if it had been possible for me to see his actual images from my desk in Rochester, Minnesota, even though he was in another state. So this is one of the great capacities that we have coming to us in terms of technologies. We have ICU care that we can deliver remotely. Mayo Clinic has been a pioneer in telestroke care. We started in Arizona and expanded actually then to Minnesota. If you think about the problem of high school concussions, we're doing a little project being able to look at athletes with robots. So we can do an assessment of an athlete on the field or in the locker room with a specialist rather than leaving that up to perhaps an athletic trainer or a coach who may not know as much as we would like them to know about concussions. So there are lots and lots of things that we could really do with these new kinds of technologies. And so being able to expedite the licensure process to help that would be for us a great help. And again, we are immensely grateful to all of you who are working on this particular project, not just for us, but for citizens of the state of Minnesota. Another problem that is becoming more and more difficult is patient access to pharmaceuticals. Medicines and pharmaceuticals are very important in managing chronic disease and being able to avoid hospitalizations as well as the complications of disease. But many patients do not fill their prescriptions for a variety of reasons, including costs. And a remarkable number of people may not fill a prescription in a period after the initial prescription was filled. So it's remarkable that about 50% of patients who have had a heart attack that have been cared for in our system will stop taking their cholesterol medicine 2 years after their heart attack. And it may or may not be because of cost. There may be other things that get in the way. But one of these things, remarkably, is the process of prior authorization. And this is one of our legislative priorities, or one of our significant interests. And what we mean by prior authorization is an unusual requirement that physicians provide additional information to a plan or a pharmacy benefit manager about being able to use a medicine or about being able to prescribe a certain number of pills. It is less about seeking an exception than some people would believe, but it is an extraordinarily intrusive problem for us in medicine. So let me give you one example of where this can be very difficult, and I'll illustrate it with this rather oversimplified graphic. So about a couple of weeks ago, I saw a woman from Mankato who was coming to me for treatment of her high blood pressure. And she was having difficulty with medication, and I looked at the list of medicines she was taking and concluded that we would have an option for another medicine. I wrote her the prescription. She took it to her pharmacist. She called me that night and said, I can't take this because the pharmacist says I have to get permission to use it. So then I get a fax from the pharmacist that says, would you please fill out the prior authorization for this medication? So the insurance company or the plan is asking for me to provide information about the use of the medicine. Now, they don't tell me why they deny it. So it could be because it's too expensive. It could be because it's not in the formulary of the plan. It could be actually because it is considered a dangerous drug. There are drugs that we have which we do not like to prescribe, especially to older people, because of their risks. But the fax comes and doesn't tell me anything. It just said denied. So it has a number that I have to call. So I call. And you can imagine that it's one of the usual things, wait for all the menus. 44 minutes later, I get a person who says, what would you like to do? Would you like to do this online, or do you want me to do it with you? So I said, well, I already tried online, and it turned me down because my credentials weren't good. So could you help me? So she said, sure. So she took all the information she entered, and she said, one of our medical directors will call you back within 72 hours. So I finally got the call back, and the call back was, we're still going to deny the medicine. So I asked, you know, are you denied because of cost or what? So it's finally at that point that I get the answer about why the original denial, and I ask, is there an alternative in your formulary that I can use? Because nobody has told me yet what I could use as a reasonable alternative to treat this patient. So this poor woman has now gone 5 days without getting medicine for her blood pressure. It would be really incredibly easy to make this work in a very different way. It's remarkable that we create these impediments. Now, that said, we are quite sensitive to costs of medicine. And I will tell you, too, that if we think about really expensive medicines, so let's think about a set of medicines for treatment of inflammatory bowel disease or Crohn's disease. So it turns out I have a son who has Crohn's disease. These medicines are truly life-saving. If you don't take one of these medicines, you're going to have lots of surgery, and you're going to have lots of abdominal pain, you're going to have lots of diarrhea. But it costs about $3,000 a month. So as I'm trying to buy insurance for them, I'm looking at all of the plans and trying to figure out who will provide coverage for this. It all says I have to have prior authorization. And I know that one of the things that will happen with the prior authorization is that it's possible that his treatment may be disrupted because of the delay, which we would like to avoid. So we certainly need to find ways that we can get medicines to people that can be done in easier ways than we're currently doing it with all of this paperwork and prior authorization. So this is, for physicians, one of those really unpleasant administrative requirements that seem not to make it easier for us to take care of people, but instead just present barriers for us and for patients. And I'll tell you at least that the pharmacist that fills my own prescriptions in the neighborhood drugstore down the street tells me he's just as unhappy about the prospect. So I don't think it's just for us in medicine that we're looking for. So we really are going to be seeing what we can do to help simplify this process and make it actually work better, especially for patients and their doctors. Again, we're sensitive to cost. We know that we control a lot of the cost in terms of our prescribing decisions, but we think there are better solutions. There are also some opportunities for better health. If you think about the health of people and communities, the determinants of health include things like education, a safe environment, a good income, a good job. All of those things are matters that are of utmost interest to you, and in your responsibilities, you deal with them in other committees as well. We actually know that they're very important, and we are incredibly grateful for the amount of work that you have done on our behalf and things like creating clean indoor air spaces. The Clean Indoor Air Act was a monument of success. The number of people in Minnesota who are smoking now is at its lowest ever. Now, some people say it takes years for that to pay off, but in Olmsted County, we saw the number of people having heart attacks drop by nearly 40% within a year after that act was passed. So if you ever had any doubt about the fact that in the things that you do here every day, you have an impact on lives and improve them, let me tell you, you do. And let me tell you, we are extremely grateful for the great support you've given us as an organization. There are no benefits to tobacco use, and we have similar concerns about e-cigarettes and vaping nicotine and other things. So we will be grateful for your continued help in making progress in avoiding exposure to nicotine and other harmful elements as well. So I don't want to take all of the time you have allocated for your hearing today, and I'm happy to conclude first with thanks. Again, thanks for your sharing our common goals of better health for all Minnesotans. And thanks again for your commitment to helping us move forward on solving the problems of workforce issues, of an ability to remove barriers to treatment, and the chance to create good health and better health for all Minnesotans. So thanks again on behalf of all the members of the MMA for the chance to spend some time with you today. We look forward to the chance to work with you and to the work that you'll be doing in this session.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wood. We have a couple of questions. I have one briefly, and then we have Representative Quam, and then we'll allow a couple more minutes or any other questions that might be there. Mine is related to on our packets, members, page 5, but one of the challenges that you brought up was needing more preceptor sites for medical student and clinical rotations. What are the obstacles to that? What is the challenge in terms of more preceptor sites?
So one of the difficulties is finding ways to pay faculty members. When you take the time to teach, it takes you longer in your day. So as a result, if you are being paid on a production basis, meaning you're being paid on the basis of how many visits you do, you will do less visits in a day, your income will be less. There are other responsibilities too. As you might imagine, there's a lot of paperwork and education administration these days. So if you want to sign up to be a preceptor, there's a lot of additional administrative work that goes on. So it's a burden not just for the preceptor, but also for the program director. So if that's the University of Minnesota's rural family medicine residency, they have a lot of extra work they have to do. If it's for the medical school, same thing. So a combination of being able to find ways that we can move training money to the rural sites especially, or to inner city sites where physicians are really anxious to help out, but need at least some help in being able to do that on a daily basis.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, looking back at the prior authorization experience, and I've gone through that, but I did, at the point of RX, when they said it's not prior authorized, dipped into my shoe and accessory budget to, you know, get my wife's prescription. And so if you've got an RX, they've got the medication, you can purchase that
but it's a prime example, and it's not just the insurance. There are certain medications that are utilized, for some cancer treatments and et cetera, that are no longer in the, federal formulary or allowed for that use. And that's why I think we're now referring to it as the ACA instead of, originally it was called the PPACA, Patient Protection Affordable Care Act. And I think too many people have, in the Fed and here, have forgotten and left out the two P's, patient protection. And I almost think that that's equal to or more important than the ACA part of it.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Wood, thank you. I always learn something when I listen to you. Thank you for that great presentation. I also wanted to go back to the kind of the horror story you told us about prior authorization, and just to sort of make it clear, and it kind of actually dovetails a bit with Representative Quam's comment. So we're talking about different insurance companies that the patient may have, right? And each one has its own formulary, its own method for doing prior authorization, maybe its own forms you have to fill out, all of those things, right? So any given provider, I mean, your story was just about one patient and one insurance company, right? But in your day, I assume that you probably might be dealing with multiple insurance companies. And I don't know the first of all, I just wanted to make the point. This is our private insurance system that we're talking about that is creating this problem. And to what degree is it also government programs? I mean, I know that the way we do our government programs here, a lot of it we do through private insurance companies. We do it through HMOs. So we take one government program and we make it multiple payers with multiple different systems. Can you kind of tease apart for us how much of it is that on that side and how much of this is on the completely private side?
Dr. Wood.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, on the Medicare side, all of those requirements for pre-authorization are handled by the insurance company that functions as the contractor for Medicare. So whether it is what's called a Medicare D contractor or a Medicare Advantage contractor. So Medicare has a structure that's kind of complex. There's Part A, which is the hospital insurance, Part B, which is for physician services, Part D is for drug coverage. So beneficiaries can elect drug coverage under Part D, and when they elect that drug coverage, then there will usually be what's called a pharmaceutical benefit manager or a plan that will then do the adjudication of the claim and incorporate the prior authorization in that. Now, if as a Medicare beneficiary you elect what's called Medicare Advantage, there's another plan involved, but that plan may do the same thing. So the insurance companies that function as contractors to Medicare take on that role. Now, in Medicaid, we do try to create a bit of a formulary in the state that we can use to guide physicians in choosing cost-effective medications for our Medicaid beneficiaries. Maybe another way to illustrate what you were referring to in your comments, Representative Lee, was to tell you another story. So let me tell you a story about a person who has atrial fibrillation or AFib. Most of us have seen advertisements on television lately for medicines for AFib. It's kind of hard to go one night without seeing them, but at any rate, the interesting part about that is that atrial fibrillation is really common. It affects about 2% of the population. One of the risks of atrial fibrillation is you can get a stroke from a blood clot going to your brain. You can prevent that with a blood thinner. Every blood thinner has the risk that it can create a stroke from bleeding. So you obviously don't want to have a medicine that's worse than the thing you're trying to treat. Now, for years, the medicine we've used is an ancient one. Well, I shouldn't say ancient. It comes from the 1940s. It's about 20 years before I went to medical school, but I guess I have to consider myself ancient, but at any rate, it's a medicine that's been around for a long time. It's hard to use. You have to watch what you eat. You have to test it all the time. It has lots of interactions with other drugs. If it were really being presented to the Food and Drug Administration today for approval, it's doubtful they would approve. But it's cheap. There are now three, and soon to be a fourth, new medicines that are available to do this job, and it turns out that at least one of them is safer than the one we've used for years. Now, in Minnesota, there is no agreement in the insurance companies about the prior authorization for these new drugs. They all require prior authorization. But the science actually tells me there's only one that I should actually use if I'm really thinking about providing the safest and the most effective alternative for my patient. But I might have to go to one of two or three different forms to try to get the one I want approved. And even if I get it approved, it's going to cost more. It's newer than the older drug. But the trade-off for people is really desirable. They don't have to worry about their diet. They don't have to do all the testing. It's easier to use. So many people want it. But when the prior authorization process starts, then they may delay deciding to use the prescription and say, well, maybe I should use the less expensive older version. And then they encounter the difficulties of using it. So if we know the science says there's one drug that's preferred, then it makes sense to me that we should have that science applied across all the plans in the state. So it would seem to me that every insurer in the state would say, this is our preferred option, and we're going to create our coverage, our benefit design to match that, and we'll try to minimize the administrative intrusion of prior authorization for that. So rather than saying you have to get prior authorization for the safest option, it's just covered. Now we can tell the patient it's going to cost you more, but I can tell them that at the beginning when I'm going through the process with them and deciding what to do. I often do that. But it doesn't make any sense to say we will require you to have prior authorization for what is the safest option.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Wood. And I think that kind of covers it. I mean, I'm convinced that obviously it's not the first time I've heard about this problem. I'm sure that others are in that same position, and it does seem like there are some things that we can do, or there should be some things that we can do to, you know, help the practice of medicine, help the patients, make things a little less complicated, and for goodness sakes, if we can do some of those things, you know. And of course, not to mention that every time we cut out some of this bureaucracy and complication, we're also saving money, because when it wastes, I can't believe, you know, 44 minutes of your time sitting on the phone, that's expensive time. That's time you could be doing, maybe you were doing some other things while you're on the phone, but you could see another patient or two in that time.
Right.
It's ridiculous for us to be wasting
right. Those
resources, having people sit on the phone to do something which really adds no value. So I hope that we can put our heads together and figure out how to make this problem better. So thank you.
Representative Dean has a question or comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Dr. Wood. First of all, thanks for practicing medicine in the state of Minnesota. You can do that anywhere you want, and we appreciate you doing it here. And with the interstate agreements, hopefully you can help folks elsewhere, but we always like to appreciate our providers who are seeing patients directly here, and want to say that also. We're right now just putting our budget together and everybody's legislative agenda for the next few months and looking at the next 2 years. But just looking ahead a little bit beyond that, as kind of the state of medicine in Minnesota, one of the things that we look at is our training programs and our medical residents and the slots, where they are, how they're filling, how they're filling over time, what kind of medical students we're getting for those slots. And I would just like to request from the MMA if there is a recent study that looks at where we are today relative to where we were and where we want to be, because that's one of the things that I keep hearing about, and never really, it's probably out there and I just haven't come across it yet, but really looked at how are we supplying the needs of Minnesotans 10 years from now and beyond by looking at the residents, and how are we retaining the residents who complete the residency in Minnesota. We want them to stay here with our rural physician programs and with other programs and with meeting interesting Minnesota spouses that keep them here. We are very excited about keeping residents here, but we need to get them here first. Can you talk a little bit about that, or maybe if you can bug people at the MMA to send some stuff our way? And we're really interested in that. Also interested in Merck funding, and didn't see that in the packet, but would love to work on that and hopefully push it a little bit this year.
So we would be happy to...
Dr. Wood.
Yes, thank you. I'm sorry to preempt you, Madam Chair, but we, of course, first are very grateful for your great help in, again, attracting physicians to the state of Minnesota. Minnesota is a great place to practice medicine. It's a great place to live. We don't have any doubt that we'll be successful as an organization in making Minnesota the best place to practice medicine with your help. And we don't have any doubt that we'll be successful in being able to retain people either. So we'll be happy to send you some specific information that will help with that. In terms of the training programs and Merck funding, of course, Merck funding is one of the things that the state of Minnesota does to help supplement payment that comes from Medicare. And ideally, it would follow the student or the trainee wherever they might go. One of the challenges is, as you're thinking about Representative Dean and looking forward, so if we look forward a couple of years, in Washington, under the consistent prod of the Medicare Payment Advisory Committee, or MedPAC, there have been recommendations to the Congress to change the formula for funding of graduate medical education or residencies. So one of the things that we may need to do at a state level is to be sure we are aware of those discussions and what they might mean for us in terms of using state dollars and resources for funding. We will probably need to think, too, about how we combine a combination of loan forgiveness and other programs that can help us attract and retain people in places we want them. I think our track record in Minnesota is actually reasonably good. We'll again, get you some specific information to help with that. It is one of the reasons that if you look at Minnesota compared to other states, the last time I looked at it was about 4 years ago, but Minnesota has a higher per capita concentration of primary care physicians than any other state. And we know that correlates with health. And if you use a measure of health as mortality amenable to medical care, which is everything from infant mortality to age 75, it's expressed as a number per 100,000 population. In Minnesota, it's about 60. The U.S. average is 103. The next closest country is France at 67. So we're in reasonably good shape, but we know because of the aging of the deliveries of the delivery force, so people my age, we've got to make those investments. So it's a pretty demanding thought from a budget perspective, but we will get you more information. We will be happy to try to give you as much as we can to help you in your deliberations for the budget in making spending choices that will help achieve, again, our common goals, making Minnesotans the healthiest people in the country.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Dr. Wood, and particularly as we focus on greater Minnesota and rural Minnesota, that we've got a lot of little tiny towns with elderly physicians that are kind of hanging on, and we want to make sure that we're able to replace those with some young folks, and it's a very difficult deal to compete But for small towns, it's an economic issue as well. We want to make sure we're focusing on that. So we do appreciate that. Anything that you could provide this committee would be great. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Dean. And I'm assuming if Representative Dean had some sort of a proposal to for spouse recruitment or get Minnesota-bound spouses for these positions, that would, of course, be a...
A lot of times, it's just the spouse that keeps them here.
Right.
Very interesting, very interesting people.
We need to invest in the spouses of these positions, apparently. Maybe. I'm sure that could be supported by everyone. We'll take whatever means we can at this point to keep our good physicians here in the state. So, members, any other questions for Dr. Wood? Seeing none, thank you so much for taking the time and the good work you do both down at Mayo and for the physicians at large across the state on the MMA. We truly appreciate it, and we'll be working with you guys as the session goes on. Thank you for taking the time.
And thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives. We're grateful for the support and the opportunity to work together.
Thank you so much.
Oh.
Yes, members, next meeting, next Tuesday, regularly scheduled time. And thank you so much. We are adjourned.
Oh no, I know Gene too well. No.
I can't see that. Oh, okay. Hi guys. No.
What are you thinking?
Not allowed to see the blue sheet.
Everything good. And again, when I already did as well.
I need to stop sitting by you, don't I?
Yeah.
I just said.
Huh?
She said she's going to stop sitting
by me. I can't sit by him anymore.
Why? Is it making
me? We went to law school together. So.